Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see all of you. And I know we're going to have a full class, so there'll be a few more straggling in. But we're very, very excited about this class, Jimmy and I are. You signed up for Christian Worldview and Apologetics. And some of you, probably all of you, already know what it entails, as I had opportunity to just briefly introduce it in a adult Sunday school class. Others of you have heard little bits and pieces of it. I've handed out an outline to you this morning, and I would ask that when I get to the outline section, go ahead and check it out and everything. And that'll just give a general overview of where we're going. And it is subject to change, but we think that we're probably, 85 or 90% on target with that outline. Well, before we begin, let's go ahead and open with a word of prayer. Jimmy, could you open us, please?
Father, we thank you for creating this glorious day for us to worship you. We thank you that we can study your word, study how it applies to our lives, study how we can affect culture, how we can understand culture, how we can most effectively serve your kingdom. We pray that you bless our learning, bless our minds, bless our hearts to warm to this subject.
Amen. All right. Well, what I'd like to do first of all is I'm going to pass around a list, and I would like you, if you would, to just write down the name of one of you, if you're a couple, and then your email address as it currently is. And the reason why we're doing this, I've got yours, I'm sorry. I send you emails all the time. They go right to your junk file, don't they? No. And you'll see, too, there that we've put, and I didn't say that because you don't respond, because you do respond. you'll notice that I've put Jimmy and my email addresses on there as well. And that's in case you have a junk box or a junk file or whatever set up on your email. You want to write those down and open it up. The reason for that is that as we go along in the class, there may be days ahead of the class where we will send you the outline, all right? That way, Jimmy and I are not running around trying to make photocopies, that kind of thing. Also, we'll be sending you helpful articles and things that we come across in our own study, especially if there are... Welcome, come on in. Oh, man. Just when I thought I was safe. but we'll try to send you some helpful articles, especially if we come across a topic in the class that a lot of people have questions about. We'll be able to just send you information directly to your emails. So just go ahead and fill out your email, just one email per person around there, and please print so that I'm not left in question when we write these down. I'm going to give a couple of examples of Christians who live inconsistent with their beliefs, all right? How many of you have heard of Christian counselors who set up clinics, and when they counsel people, they basically sound just like Freud? How many of you have heard about that happening before, all right? Actually happens quite frequently, where you'll have oftentimes very well-meaning Christians who have gone and earned a PhD in psychology from a typical state university, and then they bring what they learned about Freud and about other non-Christian thinkers, baptize it with Christian language, and then use it as a tool for counseling. You see how that's kind of dangerous? It's a pretty dangerous thing when you start using non-Christian or pagan principles baptized with Christian language in order to counsel people. That happens all the time. Let me give you another example. I have not looked this up and confirmed it myself, but I've heard it said more than once that George Barna, who does the polls, polling data, has done polls where they've asked born-again Christians whether they believe in absolute truth or not. And would you believe that a very sizable percentage of those who are polled do not believe that absolute truth really exists, even though they say that they're born-again Christians? Now, where are they getting that from? It's probably your younger, right? Your younger born-again Christians who have gone through recent postmodern and secular education, and they come out of the university saying, well, you know, my faith is good for me. I believe it's true, but I'm not going to say it's absolute truth. When Jesus Christ himself said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Again, you see example of a Christian living inconsistent with his own beliefs, with his own worldview. Now, not only do each of us have a tendency at times to live inconsistent with our own worldview, but sometimes we struggle with unbelief. How many of you, well, let me first of all ask this question. How many of you have ever struggled with sin before? All right? We all have. How many of you have ever doubted the existence of the Christian God? I've got my hand up because I have. As a Christian, I mean. All right? How many of you have doubted or had struggles with your conviction about the truth of the Christian religion, whether it's truth or the only truth? Okay? Good part of you, probably more than half the class. All right? And I'm just going to share a brief biographical sketch of an experience I had shortly when I graduated from college. And I went to a Christian university and even studied for the ministry there. We had very little or no introduction to any kind of sophisticated apologetics while I was there. And shortly after I graduated, I was reading in a science textbook, and it was actually the science textbook that I had used in my physics class at Bob Jones University. And when I got to the back, it simply introduced an argument against what has become known classically as the teleological argument for God's existence, namely that the world as we perceive it around us exhibits such wonderful examples of design, there must be a designer. Right? And I had placed a significant amount of faith in that argument in a very naive formulation. So when I sat down and I read this science textbook and it gave alternative explanations, not just evolution, it so deeply unsettled me that I eventually chose to go to seminary, and specifically the seminary I chose to go to was where John Frame taught, because I knew that he might be able to help me out with my struggles of unbelief. Was I completely unbelieving? No. I was still consistently, you know, almost every day committed to devotions, to prayer. I so badly wanted to serve God with a good conscience that literally a lump formed in my throat that I had for almost a year to a year and a half. I would go to try and speak about the gospel to people, and inside I would have this nagging unbelief. You still haven't responded, Scott, to that argument that you read. You still haven't found an answer to it. I was afraid to share it with other Christians because I didn't want them to be struggling with unbelief as I was. And I'll tell you, from the standpoint of my own experience, because I'm a Christian, it was one of the worst experiences I have ever had as a Christian. Sometimes I would just weep. Sometimes I would just lay there and cry out to God and ask him to please remove the doubt, please remove the unbelief. I would try to find an answer to it, and it seemed like the deeper I got trying to find an answer, the more questions would come up. And so when I took the class from John Frame, it helped a significant amount. And then I listened to a series of tapes by Greg Bahnsen, another Christian apologist, and that helped out a lot too. And ever since then, I've had a real interest in apologetics. So I want you to know that you're hearing at least one, and maybe Jimmy's had some struggles with that as well, I'm not sure, but who has gone, as it were, almost to the depths of struggling with unbelief. And interesting thing is, and he's not here this morning, but while I was at seminary, I got to be good friends with the Goodnights. And Dana had struggled with unbelief prior to coming to Westminster Seminary, and he understood what I was going through. And it was very interesting because one night I was, watching somebody's house for them while they were away for a few days. And I got a phone call, and it was Dana. And we weren't, real close friends at the time. We're better friends now even because we've known each other more. But he called up, and all that he said was this. He said, "Hey, Scott," he said, "how you doing?" And I didn't even know how he knew I was there at this house. He said, "Well, listen," he says, "Carol and I just called. Just wanted you to know that that we're praying for you, brother, and that we love you." And I'll tell you what, apologetics, as good as they are not the final solution to all of your doubt and your unbelief. It's also the sword, the other side of the sword, and that is showing love to those who are struggling or reaching out to unbelievers. He didn't introduce a significant apologetic argument at that time, right? He knew I was already in John Frame's class. But that Christian love was what really helped me to keep going and keep pressing forward. So really, as we look at the structure of the class, the goals of our class are threefold. We call them the three E's. We want to educate, encourage, and equip. We don't merely want you to walk away with an education about apologetics and worldview. Plenty of Reformed Christians who have great educations about things and they don't live them out in the real world trying to reach their neighbors for Jesus Christ. Our goals in this class are threefold. We want to educate, encourage, and equip the saints about the robustness of the Christian worldview and the defense of it. All right? And Jimmy and I are going to try our hardest not to get caught up merely in this. We also want you to be encouraged, especially those of you, there might be some of you now who are struggling with unbelief. And also to equip you to solve your own issues, and then especially how to reach out to others and not be knocked this way and that way, reeling to and fro when you go to the Smithsonian Institute and you're confronted with evolution everywhere you turn your eye. All right. You'll see that there's a class outline in front of you, and if you can pick that up, we'll just give you a general idea of where we're going. First of all, look at the two underlined sections. You'll notice that we're going to go a total of 30 classes, all right? About 30 classes. Section 1, or the first 10 classes, will be given over to the Christian worldview, and in it we'll be fleshing out the components of the Christian worldview, as well as looking at five specific points of study under 2B, culture, government and politics, nature and beauty, the arts and mathematics and science, and how the Christian worldview provides a basis for that. And then the second section, apologetics, we'll take 20 classes on that. We'll be going through the book Apologetics to the Glory of God, 15 classes. And for those of you who haven't got it, which is most of you, you don't need to worry about getting it anytime real soon. But the book is only, what, $7, $8?
$7.
So it's a great bargain. Yeah, can I show them that real quick just for those who haven't seen it?
$7.95,
okay. That's what it looks like. It's a great book. It's not an easy book, all right? And I'll explain why it, well, let me just introduce right now why it's not an easy book. Jimmy and I have talked about this, and we didn't want to bring a class that was just real superficial and easy. And the reason why is because the unbelief that we're confronted with every day is not superficial and easy stuff, all right? It's easy for Christians to come up with real quick pat answers to the questions of skeptics and satisfy themselves, "Oh boy, you know, I really answered this guy." And then your kid overhears your argument, or a friend or another Christian, and starts to think, "Man, if that's the kind of thinking that's going on among my Christian brothers and sisters, you know, I wonder if I should be rethinking this whole thing. I don't want to think like this, but man." We want to give information that is more sophisticated, and I use that sense not, you know what I mean by sophisticated, more complex, more mature arguments than just superficial kind of stuff. To some of these issues, because the unbelief we face is very difficult. Also, we want class participation, especially when we get to the section on the book. The book is not easy. It's not real hard. But when you read through it, you're going to have questions. And basically what we're going to do is spend a good amount of time answering questions and directing discussion about what we read in the book once we get to the book. There is going to be redundancy in our teaching. The first section is Christian worldview. The second section is apologetics, but it's more like this. The first section polarizes on Christian worldview, but there's sprinkling of apologetics through it. Second section polarizes towards apologetics, but it has sprinklings of Christian worldview through it. So it's more kind of like this rather than two completely separate sections. And we do want, as I mentioned, class participation with that. And that all being said, we're going to move on to what is a worldview. Okay? Now, what I need right now are two, and I've actually already pre-selected them in my mind, two volunteers to come up here. Sam Farthing. Thank you, Sam, for raising your hand there, because you knew you'd be selected. And also Pat. Thank you, Pat, for your willingness to come on up. No. There's not going to be anything like that. All right. No, nothing like that. Nothing like that. All right. What I want you two gentlemen to do is to stand right here, shoulder to shoulder, side by side, facing my direction. So like you here and Sam there, okay? All right. What I'm going to do is put a pair of glasses on Sam. Okay? They are clean. I've cleaned them. There's nothing wrong.
I thought I left them in the car.
If you go ahead and put those on. All right. Thank you, Sam. Okay. Now, I'm going to hold up a piece of paper. You see the piece of paper? And what I'm going to ask is this. I'm going to ask, from your perception, what would you best approximate the color of this picture? What color does it look like to you? Okay. All right. First of all, Sam.
Well,
no cheating. No cheating. What does it look like through those spectacles?
I guess a little bit yellow, off-white maybe.
Okay. How about you?
White.
White? All right. What color is it, class? White. Well, how come Sam said it's yellow? What's different about Sam than from all the rest of us here? He's wearing the goofy glasses. All right, you can sit down. Thank you very much, Sam. I learned early on in a secular class on teaching that the first thing you do is you identify the potential trouble in the class and you humiliate them at the first day so that the rest of the time you have them under control. Maybe that's an importation of that pagan thinking, you know, in teaching. His day is coming. Why do you think I chose this illustration? How does that illustrate anything about worldviews? Yes, Mike?
Because some people have a point of view that you cannot identify with, and that person sees the whole world through that point of view.
Very good.
And it seems to you that this is ridiculous and stupid and obvious, and other people simply do not see it that way.
That's very true. That's right. Now, I'm going to do something else, and probably most of you have already seen this, but before you shout out anything, what I want you to do is look at this picture. Okay? Just get in your mind what you think that is. Can you all see it all right? Okay, keep looking through. By the way, how many of you have seen this before, this picture? Okay. See that picture? All right. How many of you saw a young lady with her head turned? How many of you saw an old lady? Well, what was it? How many of you who saw a young lady are having a hard time seeing the old lady? You're having a hard time seeing it? Look a little bit closer. You see her nose right there, her eyes, her chin? You see it now? All right. Isn't that interesting? We were all looking at the same picture, but we were seeing something different. And once you got focused on a certain pattern, it's very hard to switch and adjust your mind to see the old lady or vice versa, right? So you all see both now, the old lady and the... You don't see the young one yet? All right, here she is. That's her eye. Her head is turned this way. You see it now? Like a young lady.
And
yeah, that's right. There's her necklace, and that's her chin or her jaw line, and her head's kind of turned. You see that yet, Jenny? I'll just leave this here. But, I mean, it really illustrates the point, doesn't it? Cornelius Van Til used to say it this way. He said, every one of us is born into this world with a pair of glasses or goggles cemented to our face, through which we perceive reality. Now, a simple definition of a worldview is this: a comprehensive philosophy of life. A comprehensive philosophy of life. A detailed definition, or a more full definition, is this. And if you don't get it written down, I'll send you the notes, okay? What is a worldview? The worldview is a whole network of fundamental beliefs about reality, knowledge, and ethics that function as an interpretive grid through which all information and experience is evaluated. Let me say it again. All right, what is a worldview? Well, this is, by the way, going to be our mascot in this class. I'm going to try and find a way to hang it up here. Hopefully it will survive the whole class. So you can keep in mind what we're talking about. A worldview is a whole network of fundamental beliefs about reality, knowledge, and ethics that function as an interpretive grid through which all information and all of our experiences are interpreted and evaluated. All right, it's the lens of beliefs that we hold fundamentally through which all other knowledge claims and experiences are interpreted. Well, what do I mean by fundamental beliefs? Well, what I mean by fundamental beliefs are basic assumptions that serve as criteria by which life is evaluated. These are our most fundamental and basic beliefs. Every person has these beliefs. Every person has a worldview by which he interprets and acts in the world. Now, most people couldn't define their worldview in detail, but they still have worldviews. Some people have very sophisticated worldviews. These are your philosophers or your philosophy teacher at UNC. Very sophisticated. Now, basically, a worldview can be, the way that we've chosen to analyze it, we'll look at three general main areas. All right? The first one here is what's real. The second one, what and how do we know? And the third, how ought we to behave? The top one, if you want the sophisticated or the philosophical word for it, is metaphysics. What is real? What is reality? What's ultimate reality? The second one, epistemology. What and how do we know? And then the third, how ought we to behave? What would you call that? Ethics, all right? The study of ethics. Now, we're dividing this up into three different categories, but have you ever seen, you ever been to the eye doctor, and they put you in that little machine, and you're looking through a lens, and you're trying to read the line, the 20/20 line? She says, all right, is this one better? And then she moves something, and another lens comes up, or this one? All right, and you say, the second one. All right. These three categories are like three lenses. We're looking at them individually, but ultimately, they're all going to be moved up. So you've got all three right here, and that's how people look at reality. You follow me on that? All three lenses are moved up. They don't necessarily have these all divided out and everything like that, but that is the paradigm we're going to use to study our own worldview and also to critique non-Christian worldviews. We felt that that was overall the best approach that we found in our reading. All right? Now, we've purposely chosen what's real, what and how do we know, and how ought we to behave, rather than epistemology, metaphysics. Ethics is all right. That's a pretty common parlance. For this reason, We don't want you to walk out of this class using the words metaphysics and epistemology. You know why? Because the person you're trying to talk with doesn't have the slightest idea what you're talking about. Most of them don't. If you're talking with somebody who's had a philosophy class, you can use those words. But as with any kind of communication to an unbeliever or to reach out to your neighbor, you want to use words that make sense to those people. So, what's real? What's reality? I think they understand that. How and what do we know? And how ought we to behave? So, with that in view, let's go ahead and look at the first one, metaphysics. What is ultimate reality? All right? I once heard a preacher answer that question this way. He said, "What's reality?" And he said this. He said, "Reality is the way that things really are." Is that true or false from a Christian perspective? I mean, a general idea of what is reality. Reality is things as they really are. That's reality. All right? That's true. Is the moon made of blue cheese? No. So that's not a part of reality. That's not the way things really are. Right? This is a major, major question in the history of philosophy. Now, you might think, well, what's the big controversy about? Well, there's a big controversy that goes on here, and Jimmy is actually going to talk about what's real from a Christian perspective in the next half class and the following class, if we work on our time schedule here. But just introducing the concepts generically speaking or generally speaking, there are people who believe, and you know a lot of these people, who believe that reality ultimately boils down to matter, and that's it. Matter in different states of configuration, matter in motion. Ultimately, we, if you just keep, you know, if you, this is kind of a gross illustration, but if you keep cutting up a person, you keep cutting them up and you get down, you use a laser, eventually what do you end up with? You just end up with a big bag full of matter, right? Atoms, molecules, subatomic molecules, that kind of thing. It just happens to be that that matter is in a certain configuration, which makes a human. All right? These people are called materialists, and not in the ethical sense of the word, but in the metaphysical sense of the word. They believe that everything ultimately boils down to matter. Do these kind of people believe that God exists? Not usually. You know, and you're exactly right, not usually. And that's actually a very good answer, because you know what? Mormons are materialists, but they still believe God exists. So what must that say about their belief in God? What is he? He is matter. God is made out of matter. Spirit, in Mormon theology, is refined matter. Do we believe that God is made out as a material being? No, we don't. So you've got materialists. Or how about this? What about the Eastern way of thinking? I'm talking about the Hinduism. In Hinduism, when they look out into the world and see all these particular people and distinctions and particularity, they say, well, you know, I know that all reality is ultimately one. And therefore, all the distinctions that I see are really illusion. It's maya, it's illusion. Therefore, all reality really is one, and I need to come to see that. I need to train my mind to see it. Ultimately, I want to be absorbed into it so I don't see myself as a particular independent being from other beings, but that I'm really part of all being. That's called monism, all right? A monistic worldview. And then there are dualists. Who do you think might be a dualist? Just from the top of your head when I say that. We are Christians. Christians are dualists. We believe that the ultimate reality consists of spirit or mind and matter. And that spirit can move matter. And I'm an example of that. I'm not merely a material being. I have a spirit inside of me. And the animating principle of my personality, my speaking, is my spirit, my non-material being, animating my material being. materialists don't like to hear that. They don't like the idea of attributing a ghost to the existence of a ghost inside of a machine. We're merely just a machine, not a ghost inside of a machine. We say that we are a complete human and that reality consists of both mind or spirit and matter. Now, we'll get into these things in more detail later on. So that's what's real, and that is one of the major questions of philosophy. The second one is what and how do we know, or epistemology. Now, I'm telling you, this is another big deal in philosophy. All right? You say, well, come on, all of us know what's real. I mean, all of us know this basically the same stuff. I mean, sure, some people say they don't believe in God and that, but we basically all have knowledge of this world. We all have real knowledge of this world. Would you realize, how many of you have ever taken a philosophy class before in college or even psychology? Now, for those of you who have taken a philosophy class, is there considerable controversy about this issue? There sure is. There's major controversy about this issue. You have people called empiricists. You have others called rationalists in the history of philosophy. And you know, the empiricists said, you know, we believe that all knowledge claims need to be grounded in experience, in what I can taste or touch or I can observe or conduct experiments on over time. And that any knowledge claim that is outside of my experiential realm cannot be considered true knowledge. So those people, a lot of times, say that they don't believe in the existence of spirits or non-material entities because they cannot directly sense them, they believe, through their five senses. And the ultimate culmination of empiricism was through the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who lived roughly around the time of Jonathan Edwards in the early 18th century. And David Hume taught that he brought empiricism to its logical conclusion. He said, now wait a minute. He said, if the only knowledge claims I can have are what my senses detect, and if I cannot make any inferences beyond just what I touch, well, then there are a lot of things. I can't say that I believe in God's existence because I can't touch him, taste him, or feel him. I've never experienced through my senses the future. And therefore, I cannot assume that based on how things work now, that things will work the same way in the future. That's just, as it were, kind of a faith assumption about the future or a habit of thought. I'm habituated to believe that things in the future are going to resemble things in the past. That's called the problem of induction. And we'll get more into that later on. He said, you know what? He said, in fact, I don't even know whether my body really exists, for real. Because I reach out and I touch it and I feel it, but for all I know, I might just be, as it were, a brain sitting somewhere in a bunch of nutrients, and I'm just a bundle of sensations. And there are things being perceived to me, but to me to infer that they're actually real is to go beyond what I can actually know for sure. All I can say is that I'm just a bundle of perceptions and I'm perceiving all this stuff, but whether it's real out there, I don't know for sure. Now, you all have had dreams, right? And in your dreams, sometimes you wake up and you're like, oh, that was so real, maybe you're still looking under your bed to see if the monster's there, but you realize that all your perceptions while you were asleep were being acted upon simply by a dream and it wasn't real. Well, you know, David Hume just takes that another step further and says, you know, that's the way life could be, as far as we know for sure. Now, of course, he would still live like life was real and people were real and things like that. But as far as it counting as genuine, true knowledge, we don't know for sure. All right? Then on the other hand, you had the rationalists. You've heard of René Descartes. I think, therefore I am. He said, you know, we can't ground all of our beliefs just in empirical observations because, man, a lot of times that deceives us. For example, you take a stick and you have a big bucket of water and say it's made out of glass, a glass container. And you take the stick and you stick it in the water. What does it look like that stick does? It looks like it bends. Is it really bending? No. If you stick your hand in there, it looks like your hand bends too, so that doesn't really solve the problem. Your reason tends to correct the perception of bending when you stick that in the water. And the rationalists, they said, you know, we can't ground things merely in empirical observations, although that has a part of it. Rather, we have to start off with a priori beliefs, that is, convictions before we've experienced them. For example, mathematical equations and things of that, which cannot be proven by empirical observation, but are more rationalistic and conceptual and are believed before you can prove them in any kind of real experience. So he would start off, for example, doubting everything. And he says, where am I going to ground my knowledge? I'm going to doubt everything. I'm just going to, everything I can think of, I'm going to doubt. I'm going to start off with a fundamental principle. I think, therefore I am. So he uses deductive logic there, because logic, according to rationalists, is a part of that a priori knowledge that we have. He makes an inference. I'm thinking, so I know I exist. I think, therefore I am. And then from there, he tries to build a whole worldview, not merely upon observing things, but on laws of deduction and things like that. Well, the problem is you ended up with people like Rene Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. These were three continental rationalists. And one of them, trying to use some of the same principles of inference and rationalism and all of that, came to the idea that reality consisted of little mind-like entities that interacted with one another. Another one of the guys, you know, he says, well, I believe I'm a dualist. That was Rene Descartes. And he talked about God, about our spirits relating to our bodies through our pituitary gland. That's a really weird kind of thing. It's one of the most bizarre things about Rene Descartes. I don't know a lot about him, but that's the thing that philosophers always point at and laugh at. They say, why did he come up with the pituitary gland as being the medium through which the spirit acts upon the body? All right, and then you end up with, and then you have also Spinoza. I'm trying to remember what his was. I think it was more of a, he was a pantheist. He believed that God was all and that everything is God. And so he's basically very monistic, okay? That is, that all reality consists of one thing rather than multiple things. So, you know, the empiricists would look across and say, you know, these rationalists, they start off with all these supposed certain assumptions about things, and then through deduction, they come to all kinds of different arbitrary conclusions. We need to ground our knowledge in what we can see. But then, the rationalists over here, they're like, you know, if you try to ground your knowledge in everything you can see, you end up with all kinds of problems. And David Hume showed that very clearly. Then you had Immanuel Kant, and he's the guy who stands kind of in between. All right, his name is spelled K-A-N-T. I'm sure you've seen that name because he is called the father of modern philosophy. And he said, you know, the rationalists have something good to say, but if you just stick with rationalism, it leads to arbitrariness. The empiricists have something good to tell us, but if you're radically empirical, you end up in the skepticism of David Hume. So he stood as kind of the middleman and tried to synthesize both views. What he said was this. He said, the only knowledge that we can have for certain is knowledge of our own minds. Okay, now, he said, the world is ultimately divided up into two groups. And this is important, believe me. You know, you're saying, what does this have to do with it? It does. Because you're going to see presuppositionalism has been greatly influenced by Immanuel Kant, has benefited from some of his observation. Presuppositionalist is the view of apologetics that will be promoted in this class, and we'll explain what that is. All right. You have two worlds. You have the noumenal world, and I won't even take time to spell it out, and you have the phenomenal world. Well, what are these worlds? Well, the phenomenal world is the world of our own thoughts, what goes on inside of our minds, as we perceive things as they are outside of ourselves. Now, out here, you've got all kinds of different facts and datum that's coming through our senses. And our minds, here's the rationalist side of it, this is the empirical side. We're observing, and that information is coming to us. But we have these categories in our minds, such as the idea of space and time and other kinds of windows inside of our minds through which, when this comes through, all these different windows, these a priori categories by which we interpret things, eventually they look like this. Now, we don't know for sure whether what we perceive in our world really corresponds to the things outside of ourselves. But what we know for certain is this. We know for certain our own thoughts, and we have to presuppose this in order to make things connect or be harmonious or to have an overall whole worldview. And Immanuel Kant was the first one to use the word worldview. All right? Now, I don't know if I did the best job trying to explain that, but as we go along, you know, like I said, we're going to be using some redundant concepts in this class, meaning that we're going to bring them up again and again, looking at them from a little different angle here and there, so that by the end of the class, things that may not seem as clear to you at first should be clear, all right? And we want to do it that way because these are not the kind of things that, you know, Pastor Hendricks is not going to stand up and talk about that, you know. We'll have visitors come and they'll never come again, you know, if he does that. So and it wouldn't be, you know, real helpful for that class probably. All right, now the last one, this one's pretty obvious. How ought we to behave? Ethics. Are there differences of opinion about what ought to serve as an ethical rule among people? Of course. This is the one that's the most obvious to all of us. You have people who don't believe in God's existence, and so they adopt a utilitarian view of ethics. Whatever makes the most number of people happy is the good. Whatever makes the most number of people sad or have pain, that is the bad. The Christian ethic says all ethics, all moral absolutes, are based and rooted in the character of God. God says, "Be ye therefore holy, for I am holy." So we believe in moral absolutes that are unchangeable and are eternal. So that just as it's wrong to molest a child now, it will always be wrong to molest a child, and it always has been wrong to molest a child. Under utilitarianism, that might actually change the rule, do not molest children. Because you see, there may actually come a time where the majority of people are happy doing that. See what I'm saying? So molesting children can become something good. Now, you furl your eyes, you say, wait a minute, that sounds absurd. Well, look at Nazi Germany. Don't be surprised when you hear some of this stuff. Once you get away from the North Star of God's standard, and the North Star is removed and you don't know which way to go, you never know where people's ethical values and convictions are going to go. Once you deny that there are no moral absolutes, then morality becomes founded upon the roller coaster of human experience and likes and dislikes. Think about, in our country, for example, how homosexual behavior has become so accepted among so many people. That has changed radically over the last, what, 50 years? What would you say? Maybe 30 years, yeah. Over the last, I mean, it's been radically changed. Had you talked with the average person 50, 60, 100 years ago about whether or not homosexual behavior was good or bad, what do you think the majority would say? They'd say it's bad. Now today, you have a lot of people say it's bad, but a lot of people are just going to say, well, I just don't feel right about it, but I'm not going to say it's bad. You see, you have this problem going on. You have all different ways of looking at ethics. You have what's called deontological ethics, which says that ethics are based or grounded in being or in some kind of existing being or in matter or whatever. You have teleological ethics, which is like utilitarianism, which says that, no, it's not based in the pie in the sky and the by in the by. It's based upon what makes the greatest number of people happy. And you have existential ethics. There is no God. It doesn't matter what makes everybody else happy. I am my own man, and I'm going to self-actualize myself to be and to do and to enjoy whatever I want to do and be enjoy. If I want to adopt a standard of utilitarian ethics, I'll do it, but it's my choice because I exist as me, as it were, in my own mind, before everything else does in terms of priority. And you have existentialism. People just do what they want. They base their ethics on their feelings because there is no North Star. And they realize that. And they become consistent atheists with their own existentialism. And you end up with atheistic existentialism. So what we're going to do is this is how we're going to examine worldviews. Now, if you have a worldview, a comprehensive view of reality, do you want what your fundamental beliefs are here to be in harmony with what's here or to be in disharmony? In harmony, obvious. You don't want to be saying, okay, I don't believe that we can know anything for certain, but I think it's wrong to molest children. You say, now wait a minute, your view of what you know says you can't know anything for sure, but down here you're saying that it's always wrong to molest children. Sir, you've got a major contradiction in your own way of looking at things. Or up here, somebody says, you know, I believe that everything boils down to matter in motion. Okay? And they say, that's what I believe. All right. Then you start talking with them and you find out that they believe that the concept of number and mathematical formulas have real existence apart from matter. And believe it or not, we believe that, and Jimmy's going to flesh that out. Like, for example, what's this? It's the number 2, right? What happens if I erase it? Does the number 2 still exist? Does two-ness still exist? It sure does. Where does it exist? Is it grounded in matter? It's a conceptual thing, and it has real existence apart from matter. And we would argue that abstractions have real existence rooted in the mind of God. But a materialist comes along and says, well, I believe everything boils down to matter, but I also believe that math is more than just, conventions or habits of thoughts. And it has a kind of a universal application to things. And you end up with a contradiction going on. Christians have harmony in our worldviews. And one of the ways of critiquing a unbeliever's worldview is to show them that they have disharmony or contradiction between their view of reality or their view of knowledge or their view of ethics. That's one way of doing it. We have harmony. And it's actually a magnificent, beautiful harmony as we get along. All right, now, I'm going to move from this because we're going to go into more detail with these later on. Why should we study worldviews? Anybody want to raise his or her hand and answer that? Why should we study worldviews? What's the value of it? Mike?
You want to be able to communicate the gospel to people who have worldviews different from your own, and you need to understand the lens through which they see life.
That's great. Excellent way. Sam?
It's one of the proofs of the truth of Christianity, because Christianity is the only one that has a true, consistent worldview, and all the rest are inconsistent.
Mm-hmm.
It demonstrates and proves the validity.
Very good. Very good. The scriptures set forth a worldview for Christians to believe. God wants us to espouse this worldview, to live in the light of it, and grow in our knowledge of it. Our worldview is given by revelation, and it is distinctively God-centered rather than man-centered. You follow me on that? Our worldview is theocentric. It's God-centered. Everything, like the planets orbit the sun, everything in our worldview orbits God and relies upon God for its light, its heat, its sustenance, and its consistency. Christians must first cultivate a biblical worldview and then exercise godly wisdom in relating to our culture. You know how the scriptures say it? It says, in your light, we see light. We have all the Proverbs telling us how to live wisely in this world. How about Romans chapter 12, verse 2? Anybody know that from memory, or you could even read it? Go ahead, Sam, say it out loud.
And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and
perfect. Very good. Very good. Now, worldview study, in a sense then, is even another way of looking at it would be to be transformed by the renewing of our minds in Scripture. We want our minds to be so saturated with God's revelation that when we look out through our lenses, we are seeing things rightly as God sees them. Follow me on that? And there are other verses we could look at as well in connection with that. And there's just one in particular. Colossians chapter 2, verse 8, if you could turn there. Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception. Now, some Christians have used this passage to say, well, that's saying that we should never study any philosophy. Okay? Do you think that's a right way of interpreting this passage? Debbie?
My translation
says
cheat you.
So says
what? Cheat you.
Let nobody cheat you. Okay.
What's going to be a problem?
That's a good observation. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, looking at it another way, it's easy to get cheated through false religion as well, right? Does that mean we should never study what the Mormons believe when they come to our doors? Or never, don't know anything about what the Jehovah's Witnesses believe? Don't look at anything that they've put out? Don't concern yourself with learning even the most fundamental beliefs of the Jehovah's Witnesses? Because after all, you could be cheated or deceived. Of course not. It's not saying that. I like to put it this way, and in fact, there's an academic journal that has been called this, an evangelical academic journal. Don't be taken captive by bad philosophy rather than according to the philosophy of Christ. Philosophy can be good or bad depending upon what populates philosophy, right? Is logic bad or good? It's good, but now wait, Aristotle and Bertrand Russell, one of whom is an atheist, the other one is a pagan, they were the ones who really set down and a lot of the rules of logic that we use. So how could it be good? It's part of philosophy.
Relating it back, it's the ideas that populate the philosophy in their minds that are bad.
That's right. Very good. Very good. You all see that? And a lot of times, these unbelieving philosophers actually help us out a lot. David Hume, even though he was the one who originated some of the arguments that shook me initially, he also originated other arguments to show that strict empiricism leads to total skepticism. Man, we don't even need to have Christian philosophers sit around and figure out that one. The pagan has already done it for us. And like Greg Bonson says, he says the whole history of philosophy is just nothing but, as it were, an amen to what Paul said to the Corinthians when he said, "Where is the debater of this age? Has not God rendered foolish the wisdom of the world?" You follow me? So there is a good aspect to it. And in our last couple minutes, another reason why we should study worldviews, and actually Mike already answered this, and that is because we must understand our neighbor in order to evangelize him more consistently. Now, since the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden, unbelieving people have sought to create worldviews, sometimes brilliantly, in order to suppress the truth by means of unrighteousness. Romans chapter 1. Where does bad philosophy come from, for the most part? Where do crooked and ungodly worldviews come from, for the most part? They come from unbelievers seeking to suppress the truth by means of unrighteousness. They know God exists. They know it in their heart of hearts. But they come up with elaborate and brilliantly designed lenses and put them on their faces so that they can stay away from the knowledge of God. Bad worldviews and bad philosophies are ultimately rooted in rebellious hearts. And not only that, culture is a reflection of the prevailing worldviews in a nation or in a people group. Fallen men create fallen cultures. To put it another way, sinful human nature is the energy behind fallen culture, and apostate worldviews are the blueprints that structure fallen culture. What is culture? Culture is kind of a technical definition, but not complex. What is culture? Culture is the totality of socially transmitted behavior patterns, arts, beliefs, institutions, and all other products of human work and thought. All right? We have a Southern culture within the overall American culture. Southern culture and American culture, as a general rule, share most things in common. Then within the Southern culture, you will have subcultures. Sometimes the subculture is more dominated by a specific racial group. Or maybe it's more dominated by a group that tends to organize itself around music and a way of lifestyle, the punk rock subculture. Or it's organized around religious beliefs, the evangelical subculture. And that's what we are a part of. And we even go down a little bit further. We're the Reformed Baptist subculture. Within the evangelical subculture, within the Southern culture, and in the overall American culture, and then Western culture in general. All right? It's all those little beliefs not little beliefs, but basic beliefs and traditions and things like that that have been passed down to us and that we maintain and live in the light of. Now, how are we going to get evangelical culture in the purest and best sense of the word to influence unbelieving pagan American culture? We have to know, first of all, what we're talking about. Yes, Sam?
I don't want to interrupt your thought too much, but I want to ask you a question. Do you think that the scriptures give us any reason for caution in the study of worldviews or philosophy? If so, what would you do?
Yeah, well, I think the passage we read in Colossians 2:8 is a good example of a caution. You know, make sure that no one takes you captive, you know, by bad philosophy and that kind of thing. The cautions, I think, would be the case as if we were the same kind of cautions we would have if we were studying anything that's false, or whether we were studying science and you have bad science and good science. We have to be careful that we know the truth so well that we can detect falsehood when it goes astray. As far as giving specific verses, I think of the other one in 2 Corinthians 10, 3-5, and we'll actually conclude the class on this quotation. If you want to turn there, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3-5. I really like this quote from the Apostle Paul, who himself confronted false worldviews. I mean, this is the man who stood on Mars Hill and went around and looked at the idols on Mars Hill, and to one he saw it said to an unknown god, and he knew a little bit, at least from what we know, he actually probably knew quite a bit, but as far as what Scripture reveals, he was able to quote a couple of pagan poets back to the pagans and communicate with them. And the same Apostle Paul who observed and then had discussions with the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers said this. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3-5. Do you want to read that, Sam?
For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ.
Very good. And that's what we hope that we'll do in this class, is that by the time, you know, that's what the preaching in this church does, and every good kind of preaching should do, is that by the time you've left the class, my hope is that you'll have even more of your thoughts brought into under the lordship of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that when you see something on TV or you watch a movie and some unbelief is presented and that kind of stuff, you're able to, as it were, see right through it, critique it, and then when you're talking with people at work about the movie, maybe you can even bring some things up in order to move them along in terms of your evangelizing them. Well, that will be the end for today. And I did want to mention, we'll be starting this up next time, and I forgot. Two things. If you ever, let me ask you this. If you ever miss a class, would you actually, Jimmy Thrasher is the technical genius of this class, all right? And obviously, we're recording it. If you ever missed a class, would you be one who would be prone to go to a website and listen to it online? How many of you would be prone to do something like that? Okay, basically, Ollie, I don't even think we need to make a CD. Do you want to do that then? What is it? JimmyThrasher.com. It's a little bit proud, but you know. No, I'm just kidding. but if you go there, you know, obviously the people who are not here can't hear that. But if ever you miss a class, you can go there and probably, Jimmy, how soon would it be up on the website, a given class? Like by Wednesday or by... Okay, Jimmy would send out an email. Do you all write down your emails on that as well? Okay. And then secondly, there was one last real quick bullet point. No, I'll pick it up next time. All right, thank you very much for coming.